Right. Now this is day two on the series I'm doing on how to identify and handle wicked people. So we're now starting talk six. And you'll recall that last time we began looking at what are the wicked, who are the wicked, how many are there, roughly speaking. And then we began to look at, well, how do we identify them? So what I'm doing now is I'm continuing with that broad theme of how do we identify the wicked. Because, of course, before you can even begin to handle the wicked, you must know who they are, identify them. So we shall carry on with that. Later on today, what I'll do, in the last couple of talks, I shall look at deception and deceivers. And then next time, I shall go on to look much more closely at wickedness in the church, which is a really important point to bring out, that wickedness is not something that just exists out in the world. But I would think, I mean, my guesstimate is that probably the wickedness that is in the church is worse in God's eyes than any wickedness that's out there in the world. And certainly it's of more consequence. So we'll look in May at wickedness in the church. What is it? How does it manifest itself? How do we deal with it? How do you identify it? Okay, so let's get down to talk six, continuing the theme of identifying the wicked. So let me say this. Never assume that just because a statement or an accusation or prophecy turns out to be correct, that means that the person who made it must generally be truthful and reliable. So the mere fact that someone says an accurate or truthful thing doesn't mean that they can be relied upon thereafter. It just doesn't follow. And the classic example of this would be Apostle Paul's handling of the slave girl at Philippi. And remember how Paul was annoyed by her. So this girl was going around saying, "These men are servants of the Most High God who proclaim to you the way of salvation." Now, wouldn't you like someone to keep saying that about you? Why wasn't Paul happy? And what that girl was saying was absolutely true. But it did not mean that she herself was true, or that the source of her information was reliable or valid. She was heavily demonized, and she was saying that through the inspiration of a demon. So what did Paul do? He cast the demon out of her, to the annoyance of her owners. They weren't very happy about that, because they were making good money out of her. Now, in most churches today, anyone going around making such pronouncements as that, and being seen to be accurate, and having that kind of discernment, would be immediately accepted as having great spiritual gifts, maybe even put in a leadership position. But that wasn't Paul's approach. He didn't accept her endorsement and just cast the demon out. And you might ask this, you might say, well, why would a demon make a true statement about Paul and his message and his ministry? You think, well, how does that make any sense? Well, actually, it makes perfect sense, because the demon inside her wanted Paul's followers, at least, and maybe even Paul, to be taken in by that girl's endorsement. And it hoped that they would then accept her and accept her subsequent statements as being genuine, even though they'd be false. And had Paul fallen for that trick, great damage could have been caused thereafter in Philippi by that girl going on to say other things, having been wrongly validated. So, and that sort of thing is exactly what's going on today in many of our churches. People going around prophesying and falsely prophesying, all sorts of things. False teachers, false prophets, who've been accepted naively and prematurely, without adequate questioning, without adequate inquiry. And so in that way, false members, even false leaders, have crept into churches and are doing terrible damage. And just because what a person says comes true or proves to be accurate, just on that basis alone, don't assume on the basis of that alone that that makes the person valid, makes their subsequent statements reliable or trustworthy. You've got to look much more closely into someone's character and life and their broader statements, their broader teaching. You can't validate a person just based on one or two things. It's a much more detailed and prolonged process of inquiry that's needed. So what you're asking yourself, therefore, is whether in every other way that you can think of they are consistent and wholesome. Do they have integrity? Do they teach accurate doctrine? And if they don't, then they're not to be trusted or relied upon. So what we've got to do is, essentially, we've got to make ourselves harder to deceive. Now, I don't know anyone who's impossible to deceive. I've been deceived umpteen times. You know, loads and loads of times. And not many people admit that. But I go out of my way to admit it. I want to draw attention to it because I think most people don't like admitting that. And the reluctance to admit that has a detrimental effect on others because it causes others to wrongly purport to be undeceivable when in fact they're highly deceivable. And so I make a point of accepting and admitting publicly that I've been deceived more times than you've had hot dinners. And the objective is to be deceived less often and for less time, to see through it quicker, earlier. And we have to make ourselves harder to trick, harder to deceive. And, you know, so what was being done there in Philippi, the demon was putting it a bit of bait on a hook. The bait in that case was accurate. It was genuine. It was a genuine piece of bait. Very often bait is genuine, isn't it? It's a nice little piece of meat or fish that it's a genuine piece of bait. But it doesn't alter the fact that you're being tricked and you've got to make ourselves a bit more intelligent than a fish that falls for something like that. Okay. So another point in terms of identifying the wicked. This is something I've learned from experience. The wicked will frequently accuse you or others of what they themselves have done or what they are or what they're still doing. And therefore, one of the ways in which you can identify the wicked is by the things they accuse you or others of. I've seen this so frequently. And so, also, and I've noticed this to be true, the more godly and honest you are, the more people will accuse you, the more you'll be accused. Accusation is a weapon, and the wicked are skilled in using it. It runs in the family, you see, because the Bible says that they are of their father the devil, and he is, what's he called? The accuser of the brethren. So accusation is not something that just that the devil just does accidentally now and again. That's not what demons just do now and again by chance. It is part of their consistent policy to accuse you of things. So you must expect to have false accusations made against you and against others. And, I mean, look, just a recent example. Look at the life of Ted Cruz, Senator Ted Cruz, and the things being said about him by Donald Trump. Now, which one of those two men would you say is a liar? All right, well, which one is being called a liar and who's calling him a liar? Donald Trump keeps going around calling Ted Cruz Lying Ted. And the irony of it is that it's Donald Trump who's a liar, not Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz tells the truth all the time. I've never seen him or heard him tell a lie about anything. Whereas I've seen Donald Trump and heard Donald Trump lie lots of times. And he has a very casual approach to statements. He makes it up as he goes along entirely. So you might think, well, how strange, how peculiar that Donald Trump would make that accusation against Ted Cruz. There's nothing strange about it at all. That is exactly what I would expect someone like Trump to say about someone like Ted Cruz. But because most people don't understand that, most people base their beliefs upon the things they've heard and heard most often. So if they've heard a thing frequently, it becomes truth for them. And that is why Donald Trump is continuously putting the word lying in front of the name Ted. He's putting those two words together, and those two words now going together like a horse and carriage as part of Trump's campaign, such that it causes me such dismay to hear people on Twitter and Facebook and elsewhere absorbing that, accepting that, endorsing it, repeating it. Even people within churches saying, well, I'm not going to vote for a liar like Ted Cruz. Well, what do they get it from? They get it from what Trump says. They haven't the faintest idea what the lies are that he's allegedly told. Do you see the point? Now, the thing is, that's happening on a big scale there with him. But that happens on a small scale in our daily lives. So watch out for the accusations that people make. And when an accusation is made, don't just assume that it's telling you something about the person who's being accused. The main thing that an accusation is going to tell you something about most of the time is the person making the accusation. And you need to be looking closely. You need to keep an open mind, because sometimes accusations are true. But at the beginning of anything, you always have to have an open mind. So when I hear someone make an accusation, in my mind now, what I've learned to do is to say, this accusation is being made by A about B. And then I say, what do I think about B? I need to think carefully about B. But at least equally, I say, what do I need to think about A, who's making this accusation? Now, very, very few people think that way. And that's the way to think. And that will help you not to be deceived by accusers. And it's one of the best ways of identifying a liar is the things they accuse people of. And I've been amazed in my own experience of the things I've been accused of. And the thing is, I go out of my way to be honest, sincere, truthful all the time. I don't lie to anybody about anything, ever. I'm continually telling people the truth. It gets me into trouble. So the thing is, I'll either tell you the truth or I'll refuse to speak to you. I'll refuse to answer you. And the thing is, I won't lie to you, but I might just not answer your question, or I might just sidestep your question, but I won't lie to you. But the number of people who have accused me of being a liar, a con man, a fraudster, and the thing is, the reason a person is doing that, well, there are many reasons, but one of the reasons is that they're imputing their character to you. So whatever they are imputing it to you. And there are other reasons why they do it as well. Partly they do it dishonestly because they just want to lie about you. But partly they do it, I think, almost unconsciously because they're so corrupt in their own minds that they assume that everybody else is corrupt. And they see corruption everywhere. They see you must be a crook like them, and that's what you must be. So they assume you are, and they'll say it. And I've learned, it used to upset me, people saying things like this, but I've learned to make use of that, to learn from it, to gain from it, to gain guidance from it. It's an early warning sign that you need to use. So, another point. The fact that the wicked go about things in a sly and manipulative, indirect way, rather than them being straightforward, is another way of identifying them. You need to be looking out for the absence of straightforwardness or the presence of indirect manipulative methods and approach. Beware of people who are not straightforward and who prefer to do things indirectly, manipulatively, without revealing their real reason or why, you know, what they're trying to achieve, why they're trying to achieve it. Trying to get you into things without explaining exactly what they're doing and why they're doing it. I like to say exactly what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. So everyone knows what my motives are, what my agenda is, what my purpose is. I don't want to trick anybody into anything. I'm not prepared to use manipulative advertising or anything indirect or that's going to trick a person into doing something or buying something or coming to something. I'm just not willing to. Now, people who are willing to, you need to be watching out for that. Because the willingness to do that is not only a problem in itself, per se, but it's also an indication of the person's wider character. And this is a theme that we'll keep coming back to. When you see a problem, the problem is not just a problem in itself. It's a problem in this sense too. It's an indication of that person's wider character. If they're prepared to manipulate you, then that's a problem. They shouldn't be manipulative. Mm-hmm. But the point is, manipulation doesn't exist on its own. These features that the wicked have, if you identify one of them, you're going to find others in the same person. And so when you identify one feature that's adverse or problematical, Don't just think, oh, here's a person who is manipulative, but I'm going to assume that in every other way they're completely righteous and absolutely straightforward. That'd be so foolish. If someone's doing something in one way, they're going to be doing other things too, or at least they're highly likely to be doing so. So, watch out for people who don't straightforwardly reveal their real aims, their motives, their reasons, who try to get you to take an indirect route, or they take an indirect route with you in talking to you. Because why do they do it? They know that if they were straightforward with you and honest with you, you might say no. And they don't want you to say no. They want you to say yes. And I think that you should just say to people, here is a proposition. This is what it is. Here's why I'm making it. Do you want it? And then let the person be completely free to say no to you. That is exactly God's approach. He's not prepared to manipulate us with the gospel. He says, here is the gospel. Here is my message. Here is my approach. Do you want it? And he's not willing to trick you into following him. Look at the way Jesus was. Whenever anybody wanted to follow him, he started going on about how foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. And then he'd tell them about how they're going to be persecuted and how he's going to set father-in-law against daughter-in-law and all these problems. Are you sure you want to follow me? Do you see? That was Jesus' approach. And I want to replicate it as much as I can. Jesus never tried to trick anybody into following him. Neither did the apostles. So watch out for that. Another thing is an example of this. Just there are many ways people do this, but I even saw this in a management sort of book that I once came across. It was advocating this. It's the trick of presenting an idea as if it was your idea. This is something that you're supposed to be able to do if you're dealing with a boss or a manager. Present an idea, but make it sound as if it's the boss's idea, then praise the idea, and then that'll get the person who likes praise and likes being endorsed to begin to accept the idea because he's almost subliminally coming to regard it as his idea. Do you see? That's not appropriate. Now, this was being advocated in this manual, that you should try to get people to adopt your ideas by presenting it to them as if it was their idea. This was seen almost as a virtue. That's not a virtue. It's not appropriate. You can't trick anybody into doing anything. You've got to straightforwardly say and accept that people may reject and refuse. They've got to be left free to reject you and refuse you. You can't trick people, maneuver people, manipulate people. It's not appropriate. And if people are doing that to you, then take note. And this as well, if they're willing to do that to you, what else are they willing to do to you? So let me just give an example of a person who used this sort of thing. You might recall in the last talk I spoke of a lady, I'm giving her the name Rhoda. I've never in my life known anybody called Rhoda. This is the way I go about things. So this is this lady who I'm calling Rhoda. Now, she told me that, I think I told you last time that there was this conference that was going to be happening for young ladies, and I'd suggested in the church at that time that we should subsidise, the church might subsidise the cost or even pay for the cost of young ladies to go on a conference for young ladies, and that was all, not for any other kind of conference. Now, Rhoda had a lot of daughters and nieces, and she wanted them to go to a conference. But she tried to manipulate me in a devious way. She didn't want them to go to that conference. She wanted them to go to another conference. But prior to that, she'd also wanted to get me to agree to funding her family to have to hire a 7-seater vehicle for her daughters and nieces to go to this conference in. Well, I wasn't having that. And the thing is, she then tried to manipulate me in another way. So just if you note this, she came up and she said that her niece, we'll call her Rachel, didn't want to drive so far as to go to the young ladies' conference and preferred one nearby. Now this is what she said after we'd refused to hire a 7-seater vehicle for her. All we'd agreed to do was help fund the conference. And so she then tried another trick and she said that she tried to slip it across me this way. And she said that she tried to bring God into it. And she said that She said, her words, she said, Rachel really feels that God is leading her to go to the other conference. You see? Now this is a conference that's not for young ladies, it's for something else, about something else. Now the thing was, it's not that I got anything against that conference or anything like that, that's not my point. We had agreed to help fund that particular conference, not just any old conference, but the point here is Rachel feels that God is leading her to go to that other conference. Now the idea was that I was meant to be manipulated by that. That was meant to cause me to alter my position. Because I was supposed to say, oh, well, I see, Rhoda, in that case, that'll be fine if that's what God wants. Who am I to disagree with God? And, oh, absolutely, Rhoda. And that was what I was meant to say. That was what was in the script for me to say next. But that wasn't what I said. Now, the implication, you see, was that if I disagree with Rhoda, then I'm disagreeing with God. Now, I think most of you will have come across this approach from people. I really don't like super spiritual talk. If you want to do a thing, just say, I want to do a thing. Never mind whether God wants you to do it. That's between you and God. Between you and other people, just say, I want to do this thing. It's up to you and God to sort out whether you should do it. You don't bring God into it when you're trying to get other people to support or agree with you. Do you see? Let them work out whether, let God speak to them about it. Don't you talk to them about what, you know, God is saying to you that they should do or you should do or they should agree with. That's a matter for the other people to work out for themselves. So beware of people who try to bring God into it as a kind of helpful friend to support them in this argument that you're having. So it, of course, is possible that God can speak to a person about what they should do or what even someone else should do. But in those circumstances, even if that was to happen, the point is it would never be put forward in that self-serving way, in that insincere way. Neither would there be irritation or aggression or anger if you don't go along with it. You see? And so ordinarily, God will speak to you about you, and he'll speak to other people about other people. He won't speak to you about them, except insofar as he wants you to pray for them, help them, care for them, etc. But he won't speak to you to give you manipulative guidance to tell other people what they should do to help you and how they should support you and do things for you. That's not his approach. He doesn't do it that way. So be very slow to accept that God has spoken to or through any person who shows any signs of trying to manipulate or maneuver you or being carnal, selfish, devious or manipulative. So the thing was, as I heard Rhoda say that, my stomach just turned. I just thought, oh, that is so repulsive, what I've just heard you say. And so I just said, that's great, Rhoda. If Rachel feels God is saying that to her, then she'll no doubt want to go to the other conference. And I said, but that's entirely a matter for Rachel, not for me. Now, that didn't go down well. And so when I said that to Rhoda, you know, she was livid, angry, irritated, upset. Now, why should she be? Think about it. If God is speaking to Rachel or Rhoda or whoever, what's it got to do with me? Do you see the point? What's it got to do with me, what God is saying to her? It's none of my business. If God wanted me to do something, he'd speak to me. Wouldn't you do that? Can't we credit God with at least as much common sense as we've got? If I wanted Mr. B to do something, wouldn't I speak to Mr. B about it rather than speak to Mr. A and tell Mr. A to tell Mr. B that I'd said it? Would we do that? Unless we were really pretty silly. So the point is, don't go for that, don't fall for it. So okay. Now, of course, if God is trying to speak to you about something he wants you to do, this is within the realms of possibility. If he's trying to speak to you but you're not listening, it may be that God will then speak to A to tell you B something that he's already tried a number of times to tell you but you're not listening. That is possible. But when that occurs, the messenger that God uses, A will come to you and won't speak in a angry, insincere, manipulative, irritated voice, if A is used as that messenger to sort of repeat the message God's already been trying to tell you, it won't be given in that way. Tone really matters. The style and manner of the message really matters. So if the person has been used by God to bring you a message, they won't talk to you in a manipulative way, and they won't be angry if you won't listen to them. They might be sad, but they won't be angry if they're genuine. Okay, another point. The mere fact that a person is hardworking and useful and an effective worker, whether in an office or factory or in a church, does not mean that they are also faithful and trustworthy. It means that they're a useful and hardworking member of staff or a member of the church, but it doesn't mean that they're faithful and trustworthy. At least not in itself, it doesn't. And one of the many mistakes I made as a boss, as an employer, was to assume that if a person was an excellent worker, productive, hardworking, diligent, accurate, then they must be a good person and they can't be wicked, they can't be unfaithful if they're like that. Well, that doesn't follow. That doesn't follow from that. And I fell for that trick a few times. And so some people are just good workers, hard workers, more efficient, more effective, and that's a good thing. But it has nothing to do with whether they're wicked or not. I made this mistake with a lady, I'm giving her the name Janet, and she took over as a cost draftsman and cost negotiator in my law firm. And she was one of the most energetic, vigorous employees I've ever had. She was just a bundle of energy, got loads of things done. She took over the cost department and had two previous people running it, both of whom were duds. I've given them the names Chloe and Carla, and they appear in this book from time to time. They were both duds, and Janet took over from them. They were lazy and ineffectual and made a mess of things. She came in like a whirlwind and was just tremendously effective, and I was delighted with her. But where I went wrong was to assume, by virtue of all that, that therefore she could be trusted. But she was just as false as her predecessors. It's just that she was a good worker and an effective and efficient administrator, you see. So I should simply have valued and appreciated her work rate and her skill, but I should not have taken my eye off other factors. So when I was so highly impressed with those things, it caused me to take my eye off the ball on other things, and I shouldn't have done. Okay, another point. When person A purports to be assisting you in a dispute with person B, and they tell you what B is saying, you need to at least consider it possible, if not likely even, that A may in fact be working for B, not for you. So if A comes along as a kind of go-between, purporting to seek to assist you, to act as a go-between, to help, if you're naive, you may just accept that entirely at face value, only to find later that A is supporting B, not supporting you. And A's real mission is to support B in the dispute or problem or dispute that you've got, not to support you in it. And I found that, and it involves this lady I've spoken of just a moment ago called Janet. A dispute arose in the law firm with a secretary. I'm giving her the word Yolanda. You see how confusing life is becoming for me these days. I've got to give virtually everybody in my life a different name. What I've started doing, by the way, I never use their real names anymore. I just talk about them as their made-up names, because I've got to try and learn those as the real names now, in case they slip out by mistake. Anyway, Yolanda, this secretary, brought a tribunal claim against me. She was a nasty piece of work, in my opinion. And Janet came to me after this had begun. And she was purporting to be distressed, and she said that she's in a very awkward position because Yolanda has been texting her and phoning her and talking about the case. Now, Janet came to me as if she was reporting this to me, wanting to be helpful to me, supportive of me. Now, because I was so impressed with Janet, and because I thought that meant Janet was faithful and loyal and true, I was open to this, and and listened to the things that Janet was telling me about the case and so forth. What Janet was actually doing was trying to find out things from me to pass on to Yolanda, not the converse, which she was purporting to do. So whereas she was claiming to be helping me, she was actually helping Yolanda. That's what she was really doing. Now, she didn't learn an awful lot from me because I was pretty tight-lipped anyway, and I don't reveal too much. But I probably revealed more than I intended to reveal. Even unconsciously, you can reveal more than you think. And the wicked are very clever and very cunning. They can pick up more than you realize. Now, looking back at it, I ought to have realized this. I ought to have said to myself, why would somebody as wicked as Yolanda make a mistake by mistakenly seeking to enlist the aid of Janet? Why would Yolanda make such a terrible error? If Janet is as faithful to me as I think she is, why would Yolanda not realize that and steer well clear of her? Do you see? The truth of the matter is Yolanda hadn't made a misjudgment at all. Yolanda had hit the bullseye. She was completely accurate in her assessment of Janet. It was me that was wrong, not Yolanda. I was getting it wrong. Now, in such a situation, instead of assuming that your enemy has misjudged your ally, consider it at least possible that you have done so. And so this is where it's one of the reasons why we need to humble ourselves, because too many of us are full of ourselves and we assume that we're right about everything all the time. And one of the many, many reasons why we need to humble ourselves, and there are hundreds of reasons why we need to, but this is one, is if you have that situation, that precise situation, why should I assume that I've got it right and Yolanda's got it wrong? One of us has badly misjudged Janet, do you see? Now, I just blithely assumed Yolanda had. I didn't give it adequate scrutiny or inquiry. I should have stopped and thought, hang on, either Yolanda or I are making a very serious blunder here in misjudging the nature of Janet. Could it be me or could it be her? I should have at least asked that question. And had I done so, I think I would have been better served. And the thing is, I would say this, in my experience, the wicked rarely, very rarely make any mistakes when it comes to identifying another wicked person. They hardly ever get it wrong. You know how two dogs in the street can recognize another dog from, they can smell each other, they can hear each other, they just know another dog, don't they, immediately. Doesn't matter what breed or type they are, a Chihuahua and a Great Dane, they immediately recognize it. The wicked are a bit like that. They recognize each other. They can see each other. They're more skilled. They have more feral shrewdness. Well, they have vastly more shrewdness than most of us have got. And so never assume that the wicked have got it wrong. They very probably haven't got it wrong. And you need to look into it, because you can actually turn the feral shrewdness of the wicked to your advantage. By looking at whom they identify as their allies, supporters and friends, you can actually use their feral shrewdness to help you in your discernment. And I should have said, Yolanda, I know to be a thoroughly nasty piece of work. She's wicked, if anyone is. She's enlisting the help of Janet. She thinks Janet is useful, a friend of hers. She's expecting the support of Janet. She's confidently expecting it. I think, therefore, I could have got this terribly wrong. Do you see? That's what I should have said. But I didn't say that. And this is what I'm trying to be completely frank in this book. Because any other author would have rewritten the whole thing and spoken about how tremendously shrewd and discerning he was and realized it and saw through it all and so on. But this, if the film is ever made of this book, if Hollywood makes a film of it, they'll probably get Mr. Bean to play me. Because at least in the early stages, towards the end it might be Brad Pitt or someone like that, but in the early stages, Rowan Atkinson will be playing me. And that's the reality of it. Okay. Now then, another point, and we're on the theme of identifying the wicked. Watch very closely how a person acts after they are given power or a promotion. And the point is this, power corrupts. That's true. Most people have heard of that. Most people don't know that it also exposes the corruption that's already in a person. And this is the thing. So power does corrupt. That's the old saying, and that's true. But it's also at least equally true that the acquisition of power, promotion, advancement of any kind, I've found in my experience, anecdotally, reveals what's in that person already. And so if they're already proud, if they're already dishonest, if they're already selfish, if they're already grasping, if they're already arrogant, the acquisition of that, whatever it is, promotion or step or whatever, is an outlet for what is already there. And it provides them with a larger stage on which to strut about. This is the point. And so that's why so many people abuse power, because so many people are wicked. And if they're ever given any power, they will misuse it. So therefore, they can't be allowed to have any power, or they shouldn't be, because their character simply isn't fit to be entrusted with it. And so one of the most effective tests that we can have made on us is how we handle power and authority. And that, combined with how you handle wealth, are two of the hardest tests to pass. Some people think that the hard tests in life are how you handle adversity, how you handle pressure, stress. All those are tests. Absolutely they are. No doubt about it. But I think the hardest tests are how you handle power and authority, and whether you let it go to your head and turn you, and how you handle money and wealth. Not many people can pass those two tests. A lot of people don't even get given a chance, because no employer, no boss would even trust them with it, because they can already see they're not fit for it. But where God allows you to have power or wealth, I think most people fail that test. And it's a hard test. And I would say this. When I speak of being given power, I'm not just talking about prime ministers and presidents and managing directors and things. I'm not talking about them. They, of course, have the same problem. But I think they have less of a problem than little folk. And I'm thinking of an example. One woman springs to mind. She was in a business years and years ago that I knew. Now, she was put in charge of the stationery cupboard. All right? So we're not talking about a prime minister here. We're talking about a stationery cupboard. Now, when I speak of power and authority, I don't necessarily mean being made European director of this, or, you know, international finance director of that. That is the same principle, but it applies just as much to being put in charge of the stationery cupboard. Now, when this woman took over the stationery cupboard, she became as haughty and as dictatorial as Robert Mugabe has ever been, if not more so. In fact, probably Robert Mugabe was more open-minded and broad-minded and less bossy than she was in the running of the stationery cupboard. And so she enjoyed the fact that people were required to have to come and plead with her for stuff. And you had to go and, explain why you needed it and so forth. You had to fit in with her timetable. You had to ask, and you had to ask nicely. Do you see? And she became a tyrant of the stationery cupboard. Now, if you were thinking of power and authority, your mind wouldn't ordinarily direct itself to people like that. You'd say, she doesn't have any power and authority. Yes, she does. Everyone's at their level, aren't they? It's like they used to say, if you put a peaked cap on a man, make him a bus conductor, and he becomes little Hitler. Do you see? No, there aren't any such thing as bus conductors anymore, but if you give a man a peaked cap, many, many people can't handle it. And they become Ceausescu, don't they, when they're given that. And so the thing is, people like Mugabe and Ceausescu and Assad and others, they've just got bigger stationery cupboards. That's all. It's exactly the same thing. It's exactly the same. It's not a difference of kind. It's only a difference of degree. And the degree is irrelevant because God doesn't care about the degree. Do you think God is impressed that someone's a managing director? Do you think God is saying, oh, wow? No, he's not impressed at all. He's judging your character by how you handle something. It doesn't matter tuppence to him what level of authority you've got. What he's bothered about is how you handle the level of authority that you've got, whatever that is. That's the point. And God promotes on the basis of how you handle the power, the authority, the wealth, the jurisdiction that you currently have. He wants to know whether you're faithful in what you're now doing. And the thing is this, so many, many people in employment, so many people in churches fail because they want to be given more responsibility, more authority, more power, and they're not faithful at the level they're at. And they fail the test that they're now at. Well, why would God put you in for an A-level exam when you're failing your O-level maths? Well, who's going to put you in for A-level maths when you can't pass O-level maths? And so you've got to be faithful at the present level before God will put you to the next level. And one of the ways to be faithful is how you handle power and authority. Who in their right mind would promote a person who's already letting it go to their head that they've got control of the station recovered? You're not going to put that person in charge of all the secretaries, are you? It would be a terrible error to do that. And I can think of another girl, just to show that this is not just about prime ministers. Most of us don't know any prime ministers, do we? Most of us don't know anybody big or powerful like that. And this girl called Daisy, I'm going to give her the name Daisy. She was working in a shop, and she became a key holder. Now, all that meant is that she's got a key and she can open the shop in the morning. Now, when this girl was given this role of key holder, you would think that she had been invited to the palace and Prince Charles had had there with a sword on the shoulder on either side and giving her a knighthood or something, or a damehood. All it was being a key holder. And that went totally to her head and she became, you know, just insufferably conceited about being in that position. Now that's what I mean. Watch out for that. Because if the person lets power, authority of any kind, go to their head, it's telling you something about them. And that person, as with any of these problems, doesn't have just one problem. These problems that you identify, they come together, they're linked in a chain. So if they've got that problem, they're going to have many of the other problems as well. Remember, what we're trying to identify here is the wicked. And this is one of the things that the wicked have. They don't handle power and authority properly. So, okay. Now, another point. Simple and naive people often get deceived and damaged because they fail to ask themselves what type of person they're dealing with. So, many, many simple people, that's what I'm calling us, by the way. I'm assuming most of you are simple. I'm saying it politely, I'm not saying simpletons. Simple. Most of us are naive and simple. That's what we are. That's what the Bible thinks most of us are. Why do I know that? Because the Bible keeps telling us over and over again to stop being simple. Now, why would God waste good paper and ink telling us over and over again to stop being simple and naive if we weren't simple and naive? Do you see? God would not keep on and on and on telling us something if it was irrelevant, because hardly any of us are simple and naive. I would say most of the church is simple and naive. Those are the same word, by the way. Simple, naive is the same thing. So one of the problems is that a simple, naive person doesn't even ask themselves what type of person they're dealing with. Now, how can you get the right answer if you're not even asking any question? See, one of the things we're addressing here is, how do I identify the wicked? But if you're not even, let's imagine you had not much of a clue how to identify the wicked. It would be a massive starting point if you were to at least ask the question, who are the wicked? How can I identify them? Now that is your first step. And most people aren't taking that step. So, dealing with the wicked is hard enough even for wise people to do. But the simple person falls at the very first hurdle because he doesn't even ask himself the question. He doesn't even realize he's meant to be assessing the nature of other people. He doesn't. Most people do. They just assume others are like them. So it's the same thing I was mentioning earlier with Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a crooked man, and he assumes everybody's a crooked man. And the thing is, most people who are simple and naive assume that everybody is naive and simple and sincere and honest like them. So it's called imputing to others whatever you are. And most simple, naive people just impute to others their own sincerity and straightforwardness and just assume others have that. And that's why simple, naive people are usually very poor judges of character. I think that's just a fact. And yet, very few people ever admit to that weakness of being a poor judge of character. How many people, going back, can you ever think of who've said to you that they are a poor judge of character? Have you ever heard anyone say it? I bet you could count on the fingers of one finger how many people have ever said that to you, if that. People are either unaware of it, or they're too ashamed to admit it, and they'll deny it even to themselves. And I personally, I can't think of anybody I've ever heard saying it. The only person I've ever heard saying that they're a poor judge of character is me. And I'm the one writing this book about how to judge character. The thing is that it's just almost a universal feature that people don't see themselves as a poor judge of character. But I think it's an essential starting point to becoming a good judge of character that you've got to start by saying, I'm not a good judge of character. If you wanted to learn the piano, wouldn't it be a good thing to begin by saying, I can't play the piano? Wouldn't that be an essential starting point? I think so. And then you say, it follows from this, I cannot play the piano. I want to play the piano. But the very fact that I've just realized I can't play the piano is a profound discovery on my part, which helps me to go forward and learn the piano. But if you were to just entertain the delusion that you can play the piano, if you can play the piano, then why would you need to learn the piano? If you are a great judge of character, why would you need to learn to become one? So if you confer something upon yourself too quickly, automatically like that, you're effectively saying, I don't need to enroll on any course about this because I've already got it sussed. I'm just a great judge of character. So the thing is, wicked people are much more accurate judges of character. They're much more naturally shrewd in the feral sense, as I spoke of earlier. And it's also partly for this reason, it takes one to know one. So the wicked can see other wicked people very quickly, because they've got the same motives, the same nefarious intentions, they've got the same guile, they've got the same wicked objectives. When they look at an opportunity for theft or for advancement, they can see it instantly. Naive person won't see it. A wicked person does. Equally, when they see other wicked people, they recognize them quickly. They can spot another deceiver a mile off. But there's another reason as well why the wicked are much more accurate judges of character. And that is because the statistics favor them. They're more likely to be correct in assuming that others are wicked, even if they did it purely on prejudiced, preconceived assumption where they impute their own character to others. Even if they didn't have any feral shrewdness but just did it on that basis, they'd still be more likely to be right than you. Because when they assume that others are wicked, they've got the statistics on their side. Most people are wicked. But if you assume that everyone you meet is sincere, you're much less likely to be correct merely statistically. Do you see? It's like saying this. If you were to assume that everybody has ginger hair, you'd be much more wrong than a person who assumes that everybody's got brown hair. Do you see? You see my point? So even if they didn't have any shrewdness, the statistics favour their preconceived assumption. Just that alone. But there's another reason why the wicked are more able to weigh up other people more accurately. And that is this, that the simple are too open and trusting. The simple, the naive, speak unguardedly. They reveal too much about themselves and their intentions. It's much easier for the wicked to see how the simple man is thinking than it is for the simple man to see how the wicked man is thinking. So the simple man reveals his thoughts, his intentions, his plans, where he's going, who he's seeing, why he's going. He just chitters away like a child, just letting out everything. You know how you can't speak in front of kids because they'll just repeat it? Well, the simple do that. They just chatter away, letting out everything they're thinking. The wicked don't. So the wicked don't reveal. They're very canny about what they'll say. So the simple give out too much information and make themselves easy to identify, easy to read, easy to understand. The wicked give out much, much less identifying information. And so, again, it stacks the odds heavily in favour of the wicked. All right. A separate point in this theme of trying to identify the wicked. Ask God to show you what people are really like. Pray that he will expose the wicked to you. Even ask him to pray, and this is one thing I do. Ask him to cause them to inadvertently reveal their true nature. Ask him to cause the wicked to trip up, to slip up, to let things slip, to say things accidentally that reveal what they're doing and why they're doing it. Now think about it. If your objective is to find out who the wicked are, wouldn't it be an obvious starting point to ask God to help you? Do you see? Now, how many times have you ever prayed that God would help you to identify the wicked in your life? You might possibly, and probably not, but you might possibly pray about the wicked you've already identified. But how many of you have ever asked for God's help and guidance in identifying the wicked whom you don't currently know about? Because think about it. If you know 300 people or whatever, however many, there are bound to be some people amongst those who are wicked, but you don't know it. You're dealing with them at work, at church, here and there, elsewhere. But they're wicked, but you don't know it. Now, part of your objective is to identify them, and a primary starting point is to ask God to help you do it. You always need to ask his help in identifying the wicked, and partly because they're so skilled in keeping up an act. So ask him to open your eyes. Ask him to help you to see the significance of things. Ask him to help you by getting them to slip up and blurt things out they didn't mean to say, to go too far, to say too much, to reveal too much. I've had this with people in the past where people have the wool has been over my eyes until they said such and such, until they just went a little too far. And by going that bit too far, suddenly the veil comes off your face and you can see. Because they went that bit too far. And you need to ask God to cause them to slip up and miscalculate, reveal too much to you, so that you can see them. And remember, you're very much reliant upon the wicked making mistakes and misjudgments, because they're skilled at hiding, and you're not very skilled at identifying. The odds are already stacked against you. And so you'll need some kind of mistake to be made, usually, for you to see what's going on. So ask God to cause that. And most of us never pray for any of that. That's the truth of the matter. All right. Now, the simple people are squeamish about labelling anyone as wicked. And they're often reluctant to do it until it's proved categorically. But the trouble is that by that time, it's usually too late. So by the time the wickedness of person A has been categorically proved, usually they've done the damage. Often you're at the stage where you're writing a book about the wicked and you're looking back at it. By then the damage has been done. What we've got to do is get to the point where we're able and willing to identify the wicked before, or at least during, the doing of the damage. And so many of us are very reluctant to label anyone as wicked, especially if they're in a church feel squeamish about classifying them as evil or even of having any suspicion about them. And also, many people are very confused about what the Bible says about judging. And they mistakenly think it's judgmental. It's judgmental to assess other people's teaching or characters or anything, pretty much. And if ever you've seen or heard people talking on Facebook, Twitter, or just talking anywhere, how many times have you heard people saying, don't be judgmental, judge not that you not be judged, you know? And it's what I call the unbelievers, John 3:16. It's the only verse in the Bible they know, Matthew 7:1. Is the only verse they know. Judge not. And the wicked all seem to know that verse. So if ever you're pointing out anything or criticizing, objecting to anything, they say that. Now, this is where the confusion comes in, because many, many Christians think that Matthew 7:1, which says, judge not that you be not judged, that forbids us from ever judging anybody. That's not an unreasonable assumption, given that Jesus says, judge not, didn't he? But the point is, you have to look at what does the word judge mean. Because elsewhere in the Bible, we're commanded to judge. And the thing is, in the English, especially in the King James, they use the same word, judge. And in Matthew 7:1, Jesus says, judge not that you be not judged. But in 1 Corinthians 14:29, in the King James, it says, let the prophet speak two or three and let the other judge. All right, well, what's Paul thinking of? Why is he saying judge? And the point is this, Paul doesn't use the same word that Jesus used in Matthew 7:1. So what Jesus said in Matthew 7:1 is kretēs. Don't kretēs. Kretēs not, that you'd be not kretēsed. You see? But what Paul is saying in 1 Corinthians 14:29 and elsewhere where we're commanded to judge, he says diakrino. You see? Let the prophet speak two or three and let the other diakrino. It's a totally different word. I deliberately chose to use the King James for that reference to Matthew because it uses the very same word. But this thinking has really crept into the English language, at least, that we're not to judge anything. And it's one of the devil's greatest propaganda tricks to get you to think that you're not meant to judge anything. You see? Now, what's Jesus speaking about then? The word he used, kretēs, is a very specific word. It speaks of a judge in a court or a judge in the role that Jesus will be when he's the judge at the judgment seat or the great white throne, where he will be a proper judge doing a proper judicial role. Now, for you to kretēs, for you to judge in that sense, is to usurp the place of the judge, the county court judge or crown court judge, or to, even worse, to usurp the place of Jesus himself, who is giving a final judgment on this situation, on the motives and the merit and the lack of merit of a man. So how do I know whether A or B, who is the better man, A or B? Who is the one that God is most pleased with? Who is the one that God will reward the most? Who is the one that God will punish the most? Will he punish A, who has a big problem with theft and deception? Or will he punish more B, who has a big problem with sexual immorality? Do you see? That's not our place to decide that. I don't know who he'll punish them all. I don't know who he'll reward them all. Because the factors involved in all that form of judgment, when Jesus is going to kretēs, he's going to kretēs those people. Only he is clever enough to know how to work all that out. That's not our place, not our role. It's that we're not to do. Also, it means really, don't assume a place of superiority and hypocrisy where you speak and act as if you didn't have the same problems yourself. That we're not to do. So what's diakrino then? What's all that about? And that is a different thing. It means assessing the trustworthiness, reliability, accuracy of another person's teaching or prophecy or character. Can you trust them? Can they be trusted to run a house group? Can they be trusted to be in charge of the youth group? Can they be trusted to drive the teenagers back from a trip that they're going on? Are they trustworthy to do that? Are they a safe driver? Are they a trustworthy person to lead a house group or not? Do you trust them, their Bible teaching? Is it accurate or not? Better words for diakrino would be weigh, assess, evaluate. That's what really it's meaning that. So when you diakrino, when you judge in that sense, you're not deciding whether A is a better Christian than B, or whether A will receive a greater or lesser reward than B, or whether B is less or more sinful than you. That's not what you're doing. That's krites, which we mustn't do. Diakrino, we must do. So we mustn't fall for that, because it's a trick. And where you come across anything confusing in the Bible, where you're not sure what to make of it, the thing to do is check the Greek word. If you're ever confused about anything to do with judging, check the Greek word there. And it might be confusing in the English, but it won't be if you go to the original Greek word. The Bible doesn't make any errors. And so Jesus and Paul were not contradicting each other. So therefore you must appraise, you must assess, you must deal with those things, and you've got to weigh all that up. And you mustn't feel squeamish about doing so. It's not judgmental. It's not judgmental to decide that so-and-so is untrustworthy. It's not. It's not judgmental to decide that so-and-so is wicked. God hates evil, and he wants us to hate it too. And God isn't sentimental or reluctant about calling evil by its proper name. He's blunt and frank about it. He says in Proverbs 8:13, "The fear of the Lord is hatred of evil. Pride and arrogance and the way of evil and perverted speech I hate." See, Proverbs 8:13. God isn't sentimental. He's straightforward about these things. And he wants us to be bold, strong and straightforward in calling things what they are. In Isaiah 5:20 it says, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil." See, "who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." Now, very few people seem to realise that there's a duty here. There's a duty to call evil evil and good good. There's a duty to call light light and darkness darkness. It's not pleasing to God when we call evil good because we don't want to be judgmental. For a start, we're misunderstanding what the Bible says about those words. But secondly, we're disagreeing with God because God calls evil evil. So why, if he calls evil evil, why should we not call it evil? You see? And what I'm going to do, I haven't quite got to the end of what I'd planned to do, but I'm going to stop at that point and I'll carry on in the next talk.